Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Squawker Talker podcast. And despite the Champions League wrapping itself up for 2021, the bods over at UEFA have given us a sneaky glimpse of how the picture is shaping up in the new year. And despite an epic fail of massive proportions that was swiftly blamed on a pesky IT problem, the Champions League draw was eventually concluded and there are some heavyweight clashes to look forward to in 2022. And for those of you looking for a little bit of narrative in the last 16, we have paired up each game as a cheesy derby, from the dizzying heights of the Sergio Ramos debut as he heads back to Madrid, to the road less travelled in the Jan Vertonghen derby as Benfica take on Ajax. All four Premier League sides are through, as we know, into the last 16, including defending champions Chelsea and red-hot favourites Manchester City. But with the likes of Barcelona and Borussia Dortmund already bowing out, there is more than enough space for a few surprises in the knockout stages. On the pod today, we'll be giving our reaction to all eight games and giving a prediction on how we think the quarterfinal picture will shape up in 2022. Right then, my name's Fergal Brennan, and as ever, we have Squawker's chief football writer, Mohamed Butt. Mo, in a year of tech issues over Zoom calls, frozen screens, Wi-Fi problems, do you have any sympathy for UEFA and their meltdown?
No, because you know what? We deal with tech problems. We had real problems last week with the pod, we've had problems previously with the pod. We get through it, and we don't have millions and billions of dollars and the amazing Giorgio Marchetti. You know, if we can do it without Marchetti and without all that UEFA's money, UEFA have no excuse. Sort it out, lads.
Fair enough. Firm message to UEFA. Alongside Mo, we also have freelance football journalist and broadcaster Tom Gale. A little bit of sympathy on your end, Tom. You know, we've all had issues, turning things on, turning things off again, kicking the cat out. A little bit of sympathy for UEFA or not at all?
No sympathy for UEFA. Shout out to all those freelance content creators who absolutely smashed it after the initial draw. They had the YouTube clips up already reacting to it. And then, you know, how long, what was the shelf life on that? 90 minutes maximum. So I see you freelancers. I saw your reaction and you had to go again just a few hours later.
Yeah, indeed. No, and I'm going to agree. I don't have much sympathy. And I am going to put out a disclaimer. If we have any tech issues today, I'm blaming it on Andre Arshavin. If UEFA can blame it on him, then so am I. Just pick on the little man and he'll just shoulder the blame. Right, we're going to get stuck into all eight games that have been picked out of the hat, eventually, second time lucky, by UEFA. So we're going to start, Mo, with RB Salzburg against Bayern Munich. And I mentioned at the top, we're going to go with a bit of a derby feel. Some of them are bit more than tenuous, some of them are fairly direct. So this is the Dayu Upamecano derby. Obviously, he's joined Bayern and made a massive impact. But I want to touch on Salzburg first because they're the new kids on the block in the Champions League knockout stages, second in Group G in behind Lille. It's the first time they've made it through to the last 16. Kind of difficult to gauge exactly what sort of an impact they're going to make. They won all of the home games in the group stages, but just 1 point away from home. They are a relatively young team. Average age so far this season, the Champions League's been in and around 21. So they are quite a young team, quite an inexperienced team. Can that play in their favour in terms of being brave in the way that they'll approach things? But when they're up against Bayern Munich, that are just a machine, might they just wilt under the white-hot heat of Bayern Munich?
I mean, yeah. I mean, we can talk about how good Salzburg are, and they are pretty good. They're a great, great team. They are one of the many sons of Rangnick in this draw. And you know, they're a great side. Obviously, we remember they threw at us years ago with Erling Haaland, with Hwang Hee-chan, and Takumi Minamino in that team. That was a great side. Of course, Hwang is now at Wolves. Minamino is at Liverpool, and Haaland's at Dortmund. None of them are in the Champions League. So, well, no, sorry, Minamino is. You know, so they're a great side. They've got a great young team now. They've got great young players. Now, Okafor's very good. Karim Adeyemi is phenomenal. Really, really highly wanted. His group stage, he was brilliant in the group stage. He's 6 games, 19 take-ons, 15 fouls, one, 4 penalties, three goals, 1 assist. Like, he was really good in the group stages. He was effective. He's impactful. He's been linked to Barcelona, to Borussia Dortmund. I would imagine he'll go to Dortmund because, I mean, in terms of the food order and the stepping stone, even though Barcelona are at shambles right now, it makes more sense to go to Dortmund. That's where you're going to get play every game with less pressure and you're going to be able to develop. And, of course, if the big fella's off in the summer, you step into those shoes. So it makes sense. He's really special. He's really dangerous. I don't think he'll go in January. I hope he doesn't go in January because otherwise that makes this even more of a formality. Like, Bayern are going to win, right? Let's just get that out of the thing. I mean, they've got 22 goals in the group stages, most of any team. They won every single game. They have an XG of 17.09. They're ridiculously good. And they found their feet as well. What's funny is, because in the Bundesliga, they've not been at their best necessarily. And frankly, even in the Champions League, those first couple of games, they weren't really at their best. But the games against Benfica sort of got them. They found their level. Even against Barcelona, they won 3-0 at the Camp Nou. They weren't really that good. And if Barca maybe had not just collapsed in front of them, they could have done something in that game. But by the time they met them in the second game, like, the fact that it was only 3-0 was like a virtue to Barcelona. Do you know what I mean? They were lucky. Because it was the development of Bayern, you can trace it between those two Barca games. The first game, they were kind of not really at it. Barca had to really collapse in front of them to really make something happen. By the second game, they beat Barca in second gear, first gear even. Like, they didn't even have to extend themselves too much. It was they're effortlessly good. They score goals for fun. They score great goals for fun. Leroy Sané is playing left wing now. He's back on the left. He's dangerous as hell playing on the left, playing on his orthodox side. That's where he's better. Jasmine Barber's friend of the pod, Jasmine Barber's always had made a great point about how he's better on the left because he moves into space. He's better. She's got a great piece about that. Find out and read it if you can. Bayern are brilliant. Salzburg are good. They're a really fun side to watch, and we're going to have a great time watching them, and they're going to really manfully take the game to Bayern Munich, but they're going to get killed. Like, if Bayern don't score five each leg, something's gone horribly wrong. Bayern are too good right now.
Just looking at the situation with Bayern in terms of coming through the group stages, it's not just one end of the pitch, it's both ends of the pitch that they've been absolutely dominant in terms of scoring goals and not conceding. Plus 19 goal difference coming out of the group, 21 goals, which as you mentioned is the most from anyone in the group stages. But they've only conceded 3 in 6 group games. That's level with Real Madrid. So it's not a case of Ferrari at the front and Ford Escort at the back. It's Ferrari and Ferrari. It doesn't seem to be a consistent weak point, or certainly a demonstrable weak point right the way through the team. But you're looking at this Salzburg side.
You've got rid of Alaba. That's the thing. Alaba's a great, great ball player out the back, but he was always a ropey central defender. And we're seeing it now with Real Madrid. Like, he gives up chances and spaces because he doesn't really know how to mark space. Nicolas Schüller and Upamecano, I mean, holy smokes, that's phenomenal. Upamecano is so good. Again, to reference the Barca ties, in the first game, Memphis tried to tussle with Upamecano physically. Memphis likes to do that, stick physical defenders. And Upamecano just beat him every single time. Beat him up, basically. It was like watching a schoolyard bully beat up a little kid. And in the second game, Memphis literally didn't even go anywhere near Upamecano the whole game. He spent the whole time on right wing. Like, he was running away from Upamecano. That's how good he is. He's a phenomenally intimidating force. He's a skillful player. He's graceful, dribbling the ball out of the back. We all know how good he is at that. And then Schüller is literally a walking mountain. Like, you just look at him and think, he's not a normal person. What the hell? That's like a golem they've carved out of the rock. You know, so those two are very intimidating at the back. And then behind them, you've got Mr. Personality himself, Manuel Neuer. So, yeah, the defence is really solid now. Now they can afford to play Alphonso Davies every game in left wing. And because it's Schüller and Upamecano backing up, they're not even going to get rinsed defensively like they often did when they had Davies left wing when they won the left back when they won the treble. Now they've got Lucas Hernandez. They can bring him in for Schüller. Like, and they have Schüller and Hernandez. They're an incredible team. Really, really sensational. There's not a weakness, not a weak part. Well, central midfield is now a weak point due to the absences of Kimmich and Goretzka. Kimmich maybe for long. Who knows how long he's going to have to recover. But other than that now, they're too good. I like Salzburg, but this is not. This is no contest. This is over already.
Before we move on to the next game, I do want to ask you on Kimmich. Obviously, the situation as it stands now, the likelihood is he's definitely out until the start of 2022. But there's a bit of a kind of post-it note stuck on to be confirmed. We don't exactly know when he's going to be back. If he's not fit and if he misses these games, we're obviously looking way further ahead towards the end of February. How do Bayern react in terms of replacing him and maybe restructuring their team?
I mean, I think they'll get Goretzka back. I would imagine they get Goretzka back, and they'll just play Talisa though. I would imagine they've got the players to put bodies in there. And again, the thing with Bayern is, and maybe against a better team, if they play a Man City, maybe that could really pull. I mean, you know, again, Barca managed to somewhat stay in the game for periods against them by controlling midfield because they had stronger midfield because Kimmich wasn't there, right? So, in theory, if they play, but the thing is, how many teams are actually really dominant in midfield that are left in the Champions League? Really, Real Madrid, who have the sign over Bayern. So, if they draw Real Madrid or they draw Man City in the quarterfinals, maybe okay, it's a problem. Kimmich isn't available. Maybe okay, it's a problem. But they'd have to draw one of those. There's no other team, really, with a good enough midfield that's going to dominate the ball in that area and make them pay for not having, you know, their playmaker, their key playmaker in there. So no, I don't know. It, you know, it just depends on who they draw, basically.
And I think just a good point, just to the, you know, games never won on paper, are they? And I think everyone knows that Bayern walk this one on paper and in theory and physicality. But we've alluded to there, the COVID impact. I think not the Premier League is an advantage, but the fact that they don't rest during Christmas is, I'm not trying to say they're trying to take joy in people's misery, that these ramp up in cases, they'll maybe have their spell, won't they, in December. Whereas a lot of these teams that are going on breaks, January, February, maybe that's what hits them. And unfortunately, that's maybe the only bit of light you can offer Salzburg is the fact that this game isn't played till mid-February.
Yeah, we're going to spin back to this in terms of predictions at the end of the podcast, but we're going to move on to the second game in the last 16. Tom, Sporting Lisbon against Man City. If we thought the Upamecano derby was tenuous, we've got this one down as the Pedro Porro derby, which is a hell of a stretch considering he barely kicked the ball during his time at Manchester City. We're going to talk about City in a bit more detail in a second, but focusing on Sporting just for a moment, squeezed through into the last 16, just about edged out that head-to-head record against Borussia Dortmund to get second place. They do score a lot of goals, 14 goals in the six group games. That's just over two per game. But it's a polarisation in terms of form. Three wins, three losses. It was that win against Dortmund that got them through. They'll probably give City a bit of a headache in terms of the threat they'll pose going forward, and we expect them to score a few goals, but they're way too open against what is a really slick operation in Pep Guardiola's City.
Yeah, I think if the message is you've got to outscore Manchester City, I think unless you're arguably Bayern, or, you know, who fulfills that remit as regards to outscoring them. I think rightfully, just defensive-wise, no clean sheets, did they, in that group stages. And you can debate, and I'm sure we'll get into this, about how good this Ajax team is, but when they came up against the real elite-caliber opposition in those group stages, it wasn't even close, was it? And obviously, this is the beauty of the last 16, isn't it? We are, every side is billed as being elite. And Manchester City, is this an easy tie? No, going away first off and foremost as well in terms of going out there, that's going to be a difficult challenge, but Pep's going to have his players more than up for that. There's obviously got a few ex-Benfica boys, hasn't he? And it's not that they needed any extra motivation in terms of incentive, but I can see them keeping it low scoring in that first leg. And even if by any means that Benfica, so Sporting, do manage to win the first leg, coming back to the Etihad, I can just only see Manchester City stonewalling them, to be honest with you.
And looking at City, obviously, we have this conversation every season under Pep Guardiola at Manchester City that they're favourites. Looking at it in terms of how they're expected to perform, our friends over at SPK have given us some data on this, and they're the comfortable favourites, but they're also the comfortable favourites at this stage last season, going into the last 16. But every year, there seems to be a bit of a corner turned. But generally speaking, they've fallen short, whether it's the classic Pep overthink or whether it's just a difficult opponent they've got in the last 16 or the quarters. Under Guardiola, they've only got one final appearance, which obviously was last season, where they came up short against Chelsea. Do you see the picture being any different this season? Do you think there's been a change in terms of Pep's mentality, the players' mentality? Or do you think they're ultimately just doomed to have lots of promise, be held up as they are, but ultimately something ridiculous or something silly just tripped them over?
Your eyes don't deceive you, do you? And the reason why we expect so much of Manchester City is us, particularly being in England, we see them week out, don't we? We see that extensive array of players and the lack of an out-and-out striker and the way that Pep continuously just destroys very good sides on a weekly basis in terms of the Premier League. Why we love sport, pressure. That's what I can only put it down to, because City have no excuses in terms of resources, coaches, player personnel. It's clearly so those guys getting accustomed to, I play for Manchester City. Yes, we don't have the history and pedigree, and maybe that plays a bit of a role in it. But ultimately, it's about those players delivering on the bigger occasions, and maybe some of the sides mixed with a bit of experience, a bit more know-how as regards have been there and done it. That's maybe where they come a cropper. But certainly, I think if we reminisce, 12 months or so, this was when the beginning of that Manchester City run, when they went on 20 games odd unbeaten, isn't it? So it's no surprise that we do have these expectations. But again, wait till February, wait till that pressure situation. But certainly in terms of a last 16 tie, no problems here. But yes, still question marks about their ability to go the whole way.
What does Pep have to get right, Tom, in the last 16? This cliche comes up all the time in terms of his selection and the structure of the team and the decision not to play a defensive midfielder in the final against Chelsea keeps getting brought up, and that was a mistake. And if they'd done some things differently, they could have beaten Chelsea, X, Y, and Z. And every year there's always something. He's picked the wrong player, he's picked the wrong system or the wrong approach. the time for excuses is getting shorter and shorter and shorter, because his objective is now more than ever to win the Champions League with Manchester City. What does he have to get right? What does he have to pick up from the Premier League and drop into the Champions League to make sure they do at least stand a strong chance of going all the way?
I think if we're going back to the last year's final, he boils down to that literally, doesn't he? You mentioned about the defensive midfielder, in terms of team selection. And those are the minutiae, aren't we, that we're dealing with in terms of elite sport when you're combining Manchester City and Chelsea. Yes, Chelsea, half a season under Lampard, there was all that whole caveat as regards to it. But it's about getting those big calls on the big day. And I think one of the criticisms of that City brand is that will anyone ever tell Pep he's not good enough in terms of, even if he makes a similar, you know, he overcomplicates it and gets it wrong even this time, I don't feel anyone's going to be rushing to push him out the door, are they? So, and maybe that is the slight weakness in them, that they have a coach that's largely unsackable and he'll go when he wants. I'm not trying to say this obviously has any precedence as regards to his team selection, but he knows that if he gets it right, and credit to Tuchel as regards to obviously how Chelsea approached that game, I think it's normally a case of we always overplay how much Pep's made a mistake and don't compensate sometimes that another elite side got it right on the day, which Chelsea did in that final.
Yeah, honestly, look, Chelsea played really, really, really well in the final. Ultimately, with Pep, though, it's the other thing, as I say, is getting it wrong, getting it right. If the players take the chances, they win games. And City's main problem, forget defensive midfielder, this, not that, they had enough chances to win that game 2-1, at least 2-1. If the players take those chances, they win the game 2-1. It's the thing with Pep's style of football, Barca's style of football, Cruyff's style of football, it's the same thing. If you score goals, you're going to win games because you're going to dominate the ball, you're going to be able to shut the opponent down. If you play it properly, they won't get that many looks at your goal. Ideally, you can control the game, control possession, but you have to take your chances. If you don't take your chances, teams will be like, okay, these can't score on us. They'll start going forward, pushing forward, pushing forward, and then eventually you're going to get hurt because your team is set up to dominate the ball, not set up to defend. So what Chelsea did earlier in that game was like, okay, they're going to come at us. They're set up to dominate the ball. Let's hammer them on the break. They hammered them on the break. They could have scored like 2-3 goals in 20 minutes because of Werner and Havertz's movement, right? Liverpool do this routinely to Pep. It's like, sit back, hammer them on the break, right? Yeah, they're going to dominate the board against us. You know, you're betting that they're not going to score their goals. They're not going to take their chances. The best teams do this, I should say. So, you know, that might come a cropper for City later, but for this game, I think they'll have enough to take their chances. But let's see, you never know.
Right, let's move on. Game number 3, Chelsea against Lille. We're starting to get into slightly more exciting derby territory time because we're going for the Eden Hazard derby. Although Joe Cole might have a thing or two to say about that, but I think it's fair enough to say Eden Hazard edges out Joe Cole on that one. Tom, defending champions Chelsea, obviously we've mentioned the final against City that they managed to have enough, and tactically they got it spot on the day to lift the trophy. But they were pipped in the group to top spot by Juventus, drew on the final day to Zenit. And at the time of recording, this kind of comes as part of a wider run of form where they are dropping silly points in the Premier League, draw against Burnley, draw against Manchester United, and then defeat to West Ham a couple of weeks ago. So at the point right now, in terms of wrapping up the group stages, Chelsea, consistent Chelsea, machine Chelsea, are not what they were maybe a few months ago. They have had injury issues, Kante, Kovacic, which leave two massive holes within the team. But given the fact that there is such a gap between now and the knockout stages, do you expect all that to be remedied, the players to come back in, Tuchel to start kicking things back into gear, and Chelsea being a massive force again?
Yeah, I did enjoy Martin Keown's take as regards to explanation on match of the day. What's gone wrong with Chelsea? It's due to the contract uncertainty of the centre-halves. I just thought that was an incredible take as regards to explaining Chelsea's form was because Rudiger and Christensen are sort of negotiating behind the scenes as regards to contract talk. So I think just obviously Thomas Tuchel, you know, as much as we laud him, he's still very new to English football, isn't he? Yes, he knows what he signed up for in terms of the amount of games and the quality of opposition, but you know he's not been a Premier League manager at this stage of the season, is he? And injuries have played their part. And I think again that where it maybe gives some teams an advantage and injuries and illness and whatever's going to play its part is, I do fully feel that come mid-February we will see that robust, robotic, as you said, metronome like Chelsea that we saw certainly early in the season, where many people were rightfully saying they're going to walk the Premier League. Lukaku was fit, defensively they're great. Mendy's now obviously shown a little bit of weaknesses as an armoury as regards to a goalkeeper as well. But I think if anyone was looking at this on paper, in terms of a lot of the teams were looking at Lille, if you look at obviously arguably one of the worst defensive title in Liga potentially it has. And I know there's reasons for that, but a mid-table Liga side, yes, they have some standout players, but Chelsea are going to be too much for them.
There's obviously been injuries in midfield. I mentioned Kante and Kovacic and the games that they've missed. But in attack, there's also been injury issues. Romelu Lukaku and Timo Werner have missed as many Champions League games as they've played. Lukaku got one in two before they both got injured in the third game, and then they both came back for that draw against Zenit. Lukaku got two and Werner got one. Given the fact that there is a lot of attention on Lukaku, and I'm confident that once he comes back and he gets fit, we are going to see the Lukaku that scores 20-plus in the Premier League. But in the Champions League, he's never scored more than five across all of his time at United, at Inter, and now obviously at Chelsea. Given the fact that there are still possibly some question marks over Lukaku at the very, very top level, he has impressed. I think he's a much better player than he's probably given credit for. But the Champions League, scoring big goals, particularly in knockout games, is a different proposition than scoring regularly on a domestic level. Can he do it? Can he be the one to turn the screw for Chelsea and make sure that they're getting those goals in those massive games?
Yeah, well, just look at the numbers. I know we rightfully point out as regards to Champions League, but we know that's not the be-all and end-all, is it? We look at his international record, we look at the season he had at Inter. There was a reason why they paid $100 million. But, you know, no one was questioning that, were they, as regards to when that signing was made, everyone was like, yeah, that's about right in terms of what you're getting. Of course, you know, he's had a disrupted season as regards to injuries, and we all know routine is key for footballers, isn't it? If you're banging him in every week, it becomes quite simple and straightforward for you, don't you? So I've got full faith in his ability, whether or not that means he delivers on it. But a huge strength of Thomas Tuchel, obviously, and it's an example of, you know, most of the successful Premier League managers, he exhausts his squad, doesn't he? Yes, he'll hook you at half-time if you're not doing what you're told. But Ross Barkley's getting minutes. Look at Ruben Loftus-Cheek. I'm not saying they're the answer as regards to this game and their success in the Champions League, but that whole context, of the number of games and the opportunities that people are there, he'll have a fully motivated squad to get out there and deliver. And as defending champions, Tuchel, he's a natural-born winner, isn't he? I know he sort of... It's interesting. I love his post-match because sometimes you can tell he's just bottling it all in, and he's tore strips off in that dressing room, and he tries to keep it measured in terms of those post-match interviews. But there's no question marks they're going to be up for it. They have the caliber for it. So yeah, I do feel that Lukaku has the potential to take them all the way, and that's what you need. If we look at that to City, I know he's an ifs and buts, but if Harry Kane was in this City side now at this stage of the season, winning the Champions League, you're perhaps thinking, wow, that's a bit of a game changer. City don't have that. Chelsea do in Romelu Lukaku.
Just want to take a quick look at Lille before we move on. Obviously, Chelsea are favourites in this game, Tom, but Lille kind of came through a bit of a topsy-turvy group in Group G. High-stakes final game where anyone could have gone through as either top or second. 11 points from six games. That's the lowest joint with United as a group winner. The kind of situation at Lille is an interesting one because the exodus that we expected, similar to when Monaco won Ligue 1 a few years ago, hasn't really happened with Lille. They've lost Mike Maignan, who went to AC Milan, and Boubacari Samara, who's obviously come to Leicester, changed the manager. Christophe Galtier's left, he's gone to Nice, and then Jocelyn Gouremnik has come in, and he's kind of just looked to build on what was going on with Galtier. Renato Sanchez, who was massive for them when they won the league, has struggled with injuries. They haven't fallen off the horse necessarily in Ligue 1 or in the Champions League. They're into the knockout stages, but they definitely don't seem to have that freshness and that bit of zip that they did last season, where everyone was willing in behind them to outdo PSG, which ultimately they did. But the fire seems to have maybe not burnt out, but turned down to a lower setting this season.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And I think if we're all being honest, if we look at that group, and I think anyone who would have taken any team from this group, again, if we're talking in the context of this is elite stage knockout competition, we see ourselves as someone who's going to win it. Chelsea can't be looking at Lille and thinking, oh, this is a game that we should be worried about. I mentioned their Liga form. You've rightfully explained and gone into a bit more detail as regards to the reasons for that. Obviously, David is a huge asset for them. He's a big game player. If you think, obviously, winning the title last year, he really stepped up. I've read a few reports as regards to the context of the TV rights deal over in France and how that's impacting finances. Does he go in January? If he does, you know, whatever hope they had is completely gone. But if he does stay, he is a big game player. And you know, as Chelsea showed in that group stage, that they are vulnerable if everything's not going their way. So it would take a big performance for Lille to try and upset this one, but I just can't see it.
Mo, I want to ask you about the situation with Davi, because last season he was massive for them in terms of winning the title, the amount of goals that he scored up top with Burak Yilmaz. Yilmaz has dipped a bit this season, but based on his age, I think he's 57 this summer. But Jonathan Davi has carried on. Like, his form's been brilliant in Ligue 1. He's got 11 league goals at the time of recording. He scored, as Tom said, some big goals in the Champions League. Adeyemi for Salzburg is in a similar situation against Bayern, that if he doesn't fire, Salzburg don't have a chance. Is it the same situation with David here with Lille against Chelsea, that if he doesn't turn up and put in a big performance or score a big goal, they're sunk?
Yeah, I mean, that is obviously the situation. Like, you know, Lille aren't, they don't have a stacked squad like Chelsea or City or whatever. They, you know, they can't just rotate in and out. I mean, like, you know, Tom said, Chelsea are bringing Ruben Loftus-Cheek and Ross Barkley, two of the former most hype prospects in English football, like, in. Oh, we need midfield, everyone's injured. Oh, bring in these guys. Like, look, everyone would love to have Ruben Loftus-Cheek. Lille would love to have him, just like, oh, we've lost Sumare. Bring in Ruben Loftus-Cheek. Like, they would love that. It's the squad depth is not even comparable. So, yeah, David has to have an amazing, amazing game. I think he will. I think it's likely. He might even nick a goal, although Chelsea haven't conceded to any... really, until that last game, were just rock solid in terms of defence. They conceded one goal, and that was a ridiculous goal from Shotgod in Turin. So I don't, you know, the last game was, I mean, it was farcical, but it was also the sense of, you have to remember, A, Kante didn't play, and B, they didn't need, that. They needed to win against the group, but they were already through. So there's an element of that pressure was removed from them. Do you know what I mean? So I think, like, this game, these two games, they'll have to win because they have to go through, right? And there's no cushion of, like, they're already through. They're just playing for first place now. So, I mean, Chelsea got, you know, the joke hole derby, as it were. I would imagine they'll take this pretty easily, even though I think David will do well. He'll score a goal. Maybe he'll score one or two goals, but I don't think it'll be enough. Chelsea are too good.
Yeah, I agree. And Joe Cole is absolutely definitely booked in for BT Sport for this one, 100%. Right, we're going to move on to the fourth game in the draw. We mentioned it in the intro, the Jan Vertonghen derby, Benfica up against Ajax. Ajax, Mo, were magnificent in the group stages. We're going to touch on them in a second. But the first game, the home game, is going to be for Benfica. And they were the beneficiaries, or maybe they were the driving force behind Barcelona's implosion in the Champions League. They got second place and Barca drop out, which still sounds so strange. Barcelona in the Europa League. They've never played in it as the Europa League before. They've never played in the second tier of European football since 2001. But again, we're seeing, like,
Gavi wasn't alive the last time they played in the Europa League.
It's absolutely nuts. Absolutely nuts. But their group situation in terms of coming through kind of showed this tiered idea again of there's the top team that just batter it and maybe go through with 100% record like Bayern did, and then the second team that kind of scraps it out with one other to get through. And that was the case here. They were outclassed by Bayern. They lost both games to Bayern in the group stages, but ultimately squeaked past Barcelona. And they, similarly to Adeyemi that we mentioned, David that we mentioned, a lot of their hopes are hanging on one player, and that's Darwin Núñez. Three goals in the group stages. He's really impressed. There's talk of him potentially moving on, but the support cast around him is aging a little bit, maybe not star quality. Jan Mario, Roman Yarmarenchuk, and Alex Grimaldo, who's been linked again with a move away, but they're not exactly a Hollywood A-list. There's a lot of focus on Núñez. If he doesn't fire, they don't get through. And given the fact that they're up against a really tough test in Ajax, it looks difficult for them.
Yeah, like, it's interesting about Benfica. Almost half their goals came in one game against Barcelona. They beat Barca 3-0, and then they didn't score against Dinamo in the first game. Didn't score against Bayern in the home game. They didn't score against Barcelona at the Camp Nou. So, you know, they've ridden their luck, essentially. Barcelona capitulating in Lisbon, and then also failing to score in Camp Nou was basically why Benfica threw. They're a good team. They're organised. They work hard. They play hard for each other. Rafa Silva is quite good. You didn't mention him. He's quite good. He's got a little attacking talent. And yeah, Darwin Núñez is sensational. Really, really enigmatic, powerful, robust kind of forward. Gets stuck in, you know, puts himself about and has skill and quality as well. Like, he's not quite Suarez Cavani level, but he is the next great Uruguayan striker. He might not get to their level quite, but he's be on that little rung behind them, I think. He's really good. But yeah, Benfica got through essentially because Barca shot themselves in the foot twice in Lisbon. And if you watch that game as well, at halftime, it was 1-0 to Benfica because Eric Garcia completely... I mean, I can't say what he did because it's a family-friendly podcast. But yeah, basically, Darwin Núñez ate him alive like 90 seconds into the game, and Benfica 1-0 up. And then they were 1-0 up. And then that was it. The rest of the half, where Barca were better. Luke de Jong missed a couple of inexplicable chances after some great work from Pedri and Frankie de Jong. You know, and Barca should have ended that half 3-1 up, and they didn't because it's Ronald Koeman. And then the second half, again, Barca just came out, as always, under Ronald Koeman with no energy. And Benfica like, oh, we can beat these. We can really beat these here. And they went for it. And they got the second and third goals. One was a penalty. Yeah. And then in Camp Nou, Xavi's there. So Barca are dominating the ball. They're playing really good football. But they've got no goal scorers. Ansu Fati's injured. Memphis Depay is woefully out of form, as I mentioned earlier. So they can't score goals. They can't score at all. It's 0-0. Araujo scores an amazing goal, but it's offside. Haris Seferovic inexplicably misses the easiest chance in the universe to actually put Barca out straight away. And so we go to the last game, but that was a formality, basically. Barca were never going to beat Bayern in Munich, and Benfica were never going to not beat Dinamo, right? So essentially, they qualified by getting a 0-0 draw at the Camp Nou, which was thankfully down to Barca's own profligacy. You know, they just weren't... They're good, but Ajax... See, Benfica are good, they're not great. Ajax might be great, like really great. Like, I think only Man City and Bayern scored more goals than they did in terms of, not even Man City, only Bayern did. They had 20 goals. They had a 15.42 XG, only Bayern and City had more than that. 15.1 expected goals on target, only Liverpool, Bayern and Man City had more than that. They are a sensational side, Ajax. What Erik ten Hag has done with them... they lost Frankie. They went to the semi-finals, obviously, years ago. Lost Frankie de Jong, Hakim Ziyech, Donny van de Beek, Joel Veltman, Lasse Schürrle, Frankie de Jong, Matthijs de Ligt. Like, out of that team, the gut heart was gutted out. Even Andre Onana, who was great goalkeeper for them, got banned. So he's not in that team, right? He's just come back now. They've remade the team. It's not just him, obviously. Mark Overmars, sporting director, Edwin van der Sar, club president. They've been really good as well. And those three together have just rebuilt Ajax, and they're phenomenal. Seb Haller was amazing at Eintracht, and it was like, oh, God, he's going to tear up the Premier League. Didn't somehow, for some reason, at the Premier League, didn't really settle, didn't do well. But Ajax have taken him, and he's doing brilliantly there. He's phenomenal. Dusan Tadic, another one who looked like he'd sort of gone past in the Premier League, went to Ajax. Obviously, he was part of that last 2018-19 team. Now he's still in this team, tearing it up. They're incredible to watch, Tadic and Allaire, and they've got Anthony, this young Brazilian coming through, looks really special, cutting in on his left foot, like a little Brazilian Messi. You know, they've got Ryan Gravenberch, they've got Kudus in midfield, they've got, what's his name? Timber at the back, you know, this young defender, really, really robust, really aggressive. Mazraoui is still there. He might not renew his contract, he might be leaving in the summer. Rumours he's going to Barcelona, but he's still there doing well. Daddy Blin was good, but like they're worrying, oh, is he getting a bit on a bit? What can we do? So then comes Lisandro Martinez, phenomenal left-footed centre-back. I don't know why Argentina don't start him. Him and Romero should be Argentina's starting centre-backs. I don't think either of them are nailed on to start, which is really bizarre. But Lisandro Martinez is amazing, elegant left-footed centre-back, brings the ball out. His passing for Ajax is so crucial to the way they attack. Tagliafico is really good. They're just head-to-toe legitimate, man. The only weakness might be Stekelenburg in goal because he's like 60 years old. But other than that, they're just outrageous, a truly phenomenal team. And they could tangle with anyone except for maybe Bayern and City. And even then, I'd back them against Bayern and City, to be honest, to at least give them a game. They're really special.
Yeah, massively exciting stuff for Ajax. 100% record in the group stages, and they are into the last 16. We've reached the halfway stage in the last 16 draw, so we're going to take a very quick break. But after the break, four more games to get through. Atletico Madrid against Manchester United, Villarreal against Juventus, Inter Milan, Liverpool, and then the big one at the end, PSG against Real Madrid. We're going to be getting stuck into all of them in just a second. Hello and welcome back to the Squawker Talker Champions League Last 16 Preview Podcast. Before the break, we previewed the first four games out of the hat. Eventually, as we all know, UEFA made a bit of a mess of the draw. Salzburg against Bayern Munich, Sporting Lisbon against Manchester City, Chelsea up against Lille, and Benfica against Ajax. We're going to move on, and Tom, we're going to go to you first on the first game in part two, Atletico Madrid against Manchester United. This has probably got one of the strongest derby vibes, Diego Forlán derby, David De Gea derby, Radamel Falcao derby. There's some big names there. We're not having to scrabble around for this one. We're going to touch on United first and then move on to Atletico second. I think it's fair to say, even Mo will bite his tongue and agree with me on this, United were dragged through to the last 16, kicking and screaming by the goals of Cristiano Ronaldo. 6 goals in 6 group games. Obviously, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has come and gone. Michael Carrick has come and gone. And it'll be Ralph's men that will be leading United into the Champions League knockout stages. Can't really get a handle on exactly what he's going to do in the Champions League yet. The Young Boys game was a dead rubber and he changed the entire team. So there is going to be a lot of focus in the next 6 to 8 weeks in the Premier League in guessing how Rangnick is going to set up in the Champions League. We know he likes this box formation in midfield. We've started to see it a little bit so far in the Premier League. Will it just be a case of taking what he's doing in the Premier League and transferring that to the Champions League? Will he be confident enough that the approach he adopts in the Premier League can just be copy and pasted into the Champions League? Or will he need to make some changes?
Well, again, obviously, as the time of recording, they don't have a game against Brentford, do they? Because obviously that's been called off. I think that's the unpredictable nature of it all, is that he's learning on the job. Yes, he has his templates in regards to style, and it's well reported as regards to what he's all about, but he's still finding his feet, isn't he? One of the clear thing is he's improved them defensively, hasn't he? And in terms of going into a knockout competition, your ability to not concede goals is a huge advantage, isn't he? He's going to have more time to sort of solidify that. And as you've rightfully talked about, Ronaldo, there was only reason, I know people can say about, oh, it's because City didn't want him. He's a difference maker. He knows the big occasions. And this tie for him in terms of second time round, if he would have had his pick of the teams he would have gone up against, to be drawn against Atleti. So in answer to the question, I don't know how he's going to approach it, but we know the reputation he comes with. He'll have a game plan. He'll clearly have players that have adapted to his style. And I think in terms of United, it's going to be, because, you know, if it would have been a Bayern or something like that, it would have been a straight walkout, wouldn't it? They wouldn't have stood a chance. But Atleti and their sort of basically just gradual decline. I know you can say that about the reigning La Liga champions, but in terms of elite European competition, I mean, look how they did in the group stages. They didn't even lay a glove on Liverpool, did they? Manchester United, at the time of recording, are no Liverpool. I'm not saying they are going to be anyways, but that's a huge incentive to United to sort of no fear to this tie. And Rennie, yeah, to put on a show, really, because I think tactically, if he gets this one right, we all know about Manchester United's players. It's not just all about Ronaldo. Sancho, very excited to see how he's going to be improving. If players are more and more getting better and better with time, come that game around, I think it's very exciting for Manchester United fans.
I mean, yeah, look, this is, like you said, Atleti had like 35 minutes at the Calderon where they were better than Liverpool, and then Griezmann got sent off, and it was just like, since then, nothing. I mean, the whole season has fallen apart, really. If you look at it, before, up to that point, they're thinking, oh, okay, equalise, Griezmann's got Van Dijk in a spin cycle. You're thinking, okay, Atletico going to be for real here. And then he gets sent off. And then everything after that was just been misery. But United, look, it's the Cristiano Ronaldo thing is, the thing is he creates problems tactically, positionally. For Solskjaer especially, he created problems, right? It didn't really stay position. You couldn't play on the counter-attack like Solskjaer loves to play on the counter-attack. You couldn't really do that because he's 36, can't run on the break anymore. And, you know, he created all these problems. Not the pressing. That was always a... You know, it never pressed under Solskjaer. That was stupid. So he was a problem maker. But then also, as Tom says, problem solver. Scores goals. So, you know, ultimately, this is the thing with latter-day Cristiano Ronaldo, has been this thing. He's a problem tactically to deal with. But at the same time, he keeps scoring goals, so you can't drop him. Do you know what I mean? Like, because ultimately goals are the currency of which football matches are decided, and he delivers them consistently, all the time. And like his performances in this group stages, he didn't play well in any of the games, but he was consistently the guy that showed up and scored goals. So what can you say? Fair enough. And now under Rangnick, and what is this? What's good about this is Rangnick is the kind of strong manager that has in the past gotten Cristiano to behave himself tactically. So think of Jose Mourinho, think of Sir Alex Ferguson, think of Carlo Ancelotti. You know, those guys had enough of an authority that Cristiano did what they said tactically. To an degree, they gave him a bit of freedom. Fergie especially gave him a lot of freedom. But he knew how to do so. Like with weaker managers, his personality tends to override and become too much for them to deal with, and they just let him do what he wants to the detriment of the team. So think of Fernando Santos of Portugal, Solskjaer, Carrick, Pirlo, and Allegri at Juventus, right? And even Sarri to a degree, who I think was always never really good for Juventus. But Rangnick has the authority, and we've seen it already so far in the couple of games we've seen, little glimpses of he actually is fitting in and doing a bit more of the work. So that's going to be important. Marcus Rashford's continuing evolution is going to be huge. I think, because he's perfect. He's a Ralph Ragnick player, like through and through. How they integrate Bruno Fernandes into the system, that's going to be important as well. Paul Pogba's return, question mark. You know, there's so many things going on, but you'd imagine United will be in such a great position. But ultimately, yeah, sorry, to bring it back to another reason I mentioned him in the first place is because he's played Atletico Madrid 35 times. He's scored 25 goals against them. In European football, a team he was playing for knocked Atletico Madrid out 4 years in a row, three times with Real Madrid or four times with Real Madrid, and then once with Juventus. He's got two hat-tricks in the last two times he's played them, going knockout games. You know, look, it's not even that he'll play well necessarily. He might not. Man United might not even play well, frankly. They might still not be settled in with Ragnick. They're going to win this time. That's just... Sorry, Atletico. Sorry, Simeone. You complained about getting Bayern Munich. You should have stuck with Bayern Munich, bro, because you had a slither of a chance that Lewandowski could have got injured. You have a tiny chance. If Cristiano plays in these games, you're losing. And he knows it. Simeone knows it. If you ask him privately, I guarantee you'll be like, yeah, we're screwed. Because he's just going to show up at the end somehow and score a goal.
I want to talk about Atletico before we move on, Tom. The situation that they find themselves in, yes, they are defending La Liga champions, but the time of recording, they're 13 points off the pace. They've just lost the Madrid derby to Real Madrid. And I think what you said before, this idea of a gradual decline is appropriate. It sounds mad because they are the defending Spanish champions. They are still Atletico Madrid with Diego Simeone at the helm. But I look at the Liverpool games as a kind of mirror to how they've been performing. If you compare the 2020 Liverpool games, that famous result at Anfield the night before football was closed down, to the 2021 ones this season. And as Mo said, the Griezmann red card in Madrid, then Felipe gets sent off at Anfield. They haven't lasted 90 minutes against Liverpool without losing their heads and someone getting sent off. And they look a completely different proposition from that night at Anfield, where they were gritty, where they were resilient, and they threw everything at Liverpool. They would not get beat. To this time round, fast forward 12, 18 months, and they're still good and they still put it up to Liverpool. But whilst Liverpool have gone up two or three gears, Atletico Madrid have either stagnated or maybe dropped down a little bit.
Yeah, and you can guess at a lot of things, can't you, with regards to obviously Simeone's contracts, and he's obviously paid so well, isn't he? The new stadium, the huge question marks over Griezmann's return, João Felix and stuff like that. But I think the key in terms of the reporting that went into the group stages when they were beating AC Milan, and Spanish media reporting as cowardly. When have ever the words Diego Simeone and cowardly ever come in the same sentence as regards to as a player and as a coach? And largely, you know, the wide perception is always this macho chauvinist, all about wanting it more. But tactically, he's shown with those, you know, those previous successes, those runs to the finals and semi-finals. But yeah, it is just running out of gas, and just offensively, I think, more than anything, that I can't see the, you know, Suarez last year, we were speaking before the pod recording in regards to, he was a man seeking redemption, wasn't he? That's clearly not working now. And who is that player in the Atleti team that's going to look at this? Similar to, you know, it's not who goes up against Cristiano, but in Cristiano, they know they've got someone who, when the moment falls to it, will take that chance. He'll be ruthless and he'll decide the game. At the moment, just Atleti, I can't see it, I'm afraid. I can't see it. Similar to Mo, I don't want to try and offend any Atleti fans, but I'm just the Champions League campaign full stop. It's just going to go out with a whimper, I do feel.
Yeah, I think the interesting comparison there is Ronaldo and Suarez. And you look at the numbers based on them so far this season, 6 Champions League goals for Ronaldo this season and just 1 for Suarez. And it's interesting to note from last season when he banged in 21 league goals as Atletico won the league, he didn't score a single Champions League goal last season. He only has 1 goal in Europe for Atletico in 18 months. So I think that's quite telling about the position that Luis Suarez in. Right, we're going to move on to Villarreal Juventus. Again, the derby theme, the Alessio Tacchinardi derby, which again, definitely gets thrown on the list of tenuous. Sorry about that, Mr. Tacchinardi. Mo, Unai Emery has kind of made a bit of a habit of being successful in the Europa League, but he's trying his hand at the Champions League this time round. Villarreal qualified in second place in behind United, or I should say in behind Ronaldo, because it was Ronaldo that beat them, maybe not Manchester United. And it's an interesting position that they find themselves in.
Well, Ronaldo and De Gea.
Ronaldo and De Gea. Okay, we'll be fair to David De Gea on that one. Gerard Moreno, fantastic season last year, getting them to the Europa League final. He's still a big threat for them up top. He didn't maybe show his best form against Manchester United. But Arnaut Danjuma is a really exciting prospect. He's got 3 goals in the Champions League so far this season. And when he was warming the bench with Bournemouth, I don't think many people could have seen him as potentially tearing the Champions League up. But that's how Emery likes to play these types of situations. You look at his team, the old adage of maybe not a lot of stars. You look at some of the little partnerships, Pau Torres and Raul Albiol, the kind of young up-and-coming defender against the old war dog. Dani Pareco and Etienne Capoue are not household European names. I don't want to call them a ragtag band, but they're not powerhouses in the Champions League in terms of players, in terms of reputation. But Emery doesn't want that. That was what he built his Sevilla sides on in the Europa League to be successful. He built them on being a unit with star quality in the right areas. We saw against United, they can cause team problems. And against the Juventus team that are not the beast of old, they could stand a chance in this one.
This is a very sort of weird tie to analyse because both teams are basically underwhelming. Like, if we're being honest, like, Juventus are miserable. Where are they in Serie A? Like, fifth? You know, they're not having a great season. You know, Villarreal are, like, bad, frankly. Like, if we're being perfectly honest, they're not very good at all. They should have been good. They've got a great team. They've won the Europa League last year. They should be good. Yeah, Juventus are seventh, sorry, I should say. And Villarreal are... Villarreal are flipping 13th. So this is two underwhelming teams, not really at the best. I still don't know how. Oh, I know how. Juventus beat Chelsea 1-0. And they beat, because if you watch the game, Lukaku missed a bunch of chances, basically. And then they scored from shot god. One amazing goal past Mendy. They're not very good. You know, they've paid the price for years of this sort of weird transfer policy where they look for free agents, look for bargains, they sort of build a ragtag bunch of teams, and they've built it off the strength of Bonucci and Chiellini at the back and Buffon. But then they signed Cristiano to that, but then Cristiano doesn't really meld with those guys, so it doesn't really work. And then Dybala was put out by Cristiano's arrival, so he's never really gotten back to his mojo. You know, and now they've lost Buffon, they've got Szczesny in goal. You can't win the Champions League with Szczesny in goal. Bonucci's getting older, Chiellini's getting older. They've got De Ligt, who's really good, but he's like holding it down by himself almost. You know, they're just not very good. The game is going to be settled. I think this tie is going to be settled by a couple of moments of individual genius from someone. I think it's going to be a very high scoring tie. I think there'll be a goal or two from someone that will just change everything. So I'm looking at specifically like Danjuma, maybe Jeremy Pino for Villarreal on the other flank. They're very quick. Maybe Chukwueze coming off the bench for Villarreal. These very quick young forwards they've got. Maybe Gerard Moreno. And then on Juventus' side, it's going to be Chiesa or Dybala, right? If someone does anything for those guys, it's going to be one of those two.
Yeah, I think what Mo's very nicely tried to say there is two rubbish teams up against each other and probably neither of them on paper deserving to go through. But one of them will do, and we're going to be discussing that in the previews at the end where we get the predictions off the two guys. Moving on, game number 7, Inter Milan against Liverpool. Philip Coutinho is the link between these two, Tom, although he's probably not massively fondly remembered by either sets of fans, but for different reasons. Inter found themselves in a slightly similar situation to Lille in terms of the summer, that there was expected to be this rollback. Antonio Conte left, citing the fact that he wasn't being given any money to strengthen the team. Romelu Lukaku, obviously, as we mentioned, went back to Chelsea. But they've not replaced them directly, but Simeone Inzaghi's come in for Conte and Edin Dzeko's come in for Romelu Lukaku. Dzeko is scoring goals, not with the regularity or the level of performance as Lukaku, but they're top of the league as it stands, narrow lead as it is. But looking at the results in the group stages, I think they still fall into this tiered system because they couldn't really lay a glove on Real Madrid. Real Madrid were fairly comfortable in both games against them. Second place was deserved because they were better than Sheriff and Shakhtar. But ultimately, against the Liverpool team that are absolutely flying, they're going to find this really, really difficult.
Yeah, and I think you sort of, it's hard to sort of take it much further than that, as the, you know, look at Liverpool in those group stages, weren't you? I know we can debate as regards to XG number, goals scored, but in terms of the teams that I watched, and of course, through conscious biased eyes of English, you know, being a regular English football reporter, Liverpool just, even when they were qualified, didn't they? And the, you know, Klopp played around with the formation as well. They were still just so ruthless, weren't they, as regards to how then? And that's how, you know, that's what Klopp's been largely build for, wasn't he? He's just sometimes he's this sort of grumpy monster, isn't he, sort of thing, because he's so relentless. And we had that slight dip in the Van Dijk, and you said about Liverpool fans not remembering Coutinho quite that fondly. Well, if Barca didn't pay all that money, Virgil van Dijk comes through the door, doesn't he? And it's like, you know, that's the sort of game changer it is. And that's the thing with Liverpool, isn't it? Even though I'm not going to rightfully, as people talk about the Africa Cup of Nations, stuff like that, hates me when people get all negative about that, because Salah and Mane probably could come back on a high and really kick into this sort of Champions League. But we have shown with the Van Dijk injury last season that a major blow on whatever circumstances is. They can be rattled, can't they? And they'll be dealing with a lot of issues. But that's just me clutching at straws, building up an argument for Inter. It's always interesting when players move on. Lautaro Martinez, in terms of, obviously, he was great with Lukaku, wasn't he? And now he's given a bit more of a spotlight. The ownership's on him domestically in the league. He stepped up to that job, doesn't he? Now it's him to, you know, if he's going to go for any big money in the future, isn't it? It's games like this that will define whether or not, or who he goes to, doesn't it? So you look at people like that as regards to, this is a huge incentive. But again, fingers crossed, time recording, Anfield fans back. You know, I think it's a straightforward Liverpool victory, but I think it would be, across two legs, a very good game, two very good games of football.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's going to be great to watch Lautaro, Nico Barella come up against that Liverpool infield, trying to unlock Liverpool defence. Lautaro's really good. Dzeko, of course, historically has always done pretty well against Liverpool. So, you know, he's still there kicking about in his own, in his dotage. Bastoni at the back is going to be, Bastoni versus Salah is what I'm looking forward to be honest. Bastoni's this left-footed centre-back. He's built like a flipping, I don't know, like a tree. Like, he's really big, strong, broad shoulders. He's quick. He's left-footed. He can pass the ball, can dribble the ball. Watching him and Salah is going to be fantastic. That's going to be the highlight of the tie for me. Inter can hang about, man. Inter got a good midfield. Brozovic, Barella, you know, Sensi, and then Çalhanoğlu. They could, if, and I'm not saying they will, because I don't think they will, but if they can get hold of the midfield and dominate the ball and slow the ball down. Again, Liverpool's midfield is a pressing midfield. It's not a passing midfield. I mean, Thiago is very good. But if they can control the midfield, which I think you can do against Liverpool, they could have some joy in the first leg. When they got to go to Anfield with about a bajillion screaming fans, it's over, bro. It's over. Unless they walk in there with a 5-0 lead, which they're not going to do. It's over. Like the way... I still don't understand how Atletico won. Oh, I don't know. Atletico won there that night because Jan Oblak went Superman and Salah and Firmino and Mane were like, we're just going to miss loads of easy chances. That was a one in a million result. It's not going to happen again. I mean, unless Alisson and Kelleher both get injured and then Adrian has to play again. And for some reason, Salah and Mane both get injured. And Jota would have to get injured now as well because he's in the squad. Come on. It's not... Look, I think Inter can get a result in the first leg. Maybe not a win, but definitely a draw. I think they've got a really good team. They've got a really good midfield. They're not getting anything out of Anfield. Klopp will just, you know, just grind them into the dust. He's, like Tom says, ruthless. It's brutal. It's going to be a comfortable win at Anfield, I think.
Before we wrap up with PSG and Real Madrid, Tom, I just want to ask you about Liverpool. We talked about United, City and Chelsea, and there is question marks in various different areas. City, will Pep overthink? United, are they just solely reliant on Ronaldo and what will Rangnick do? Chelsea, can they get out of this little stumble? Can Lukaku score the goals? But when it comes to Liverpool, the notes that I've written for the podcast here, there's very little to kind of look to see where there's maybe a point of controversy. We can probably pick eight, if not nine, nailed on starters that are going to be in the team. We know there's going to be a focus on Alexander-Arnold and Robertson. Jota, Mane and Salah, provided they're all fit, they'll all play and they'll look to impose themselves on Inter. That must be a massive bonus for Liverpool because all these other managers are having to deal with all these juggling these balls in the air, whereas Klopp knows my team, my players are this good. All I've got to do is say to them, go out and do what you do every week, and you'll win.
Yeah, and as we talked about, scoring goals is why we love football. It's how football's decided, and their ability to, whoever the opposition is, score, you know. And that's what's got to be incredibly daunting in terms of Inter, what you're thinking. So, you know, maybe you can negate it with the midfield, and look, can we get a Trent? Can we get him defensively? But ultimately, Liverpool are going to score. Liverpool are going to score probably a banker, at least two goals, aren't they? And that's what you always have to. And I think I've talked about the Van Dijk factor. That's the only thing that Klopp has never really been able to solve, has he? As he got to when Van Dijk went, the scenario at the time, they played youngsters, Nate Phillips and stuff like that. It just didn't quite work, did it? That's the only time that he's not been able to find a solution, has he? There's been various scenarios and other instances, the use of James Milner and the adaptability of that midfield as well. Now, Oxlade-Chamberlain, I'm not sure he'll ever hit the heights that we thought he potentially could, but him coming back in, Thiago Silva looks the player that we all thought they'd sign this year. He's taken his time in embedding, but he's the baller that we all know and love, don't we? So, yeah, there's, as you mentioned, it's hard to put any weakness at Liverpool other than the current climate that we're working in, COVID, injuries, you know, of escaping that, this is a straightforward, hands down Liverpool victory.
Yeah, and I think if you're looking for signs, if you're looking for the four horsemen of the apocalypse, Nat Phillips doing Cruyff turns inside the box in the San Siro, just put Liverpool's name on the trophy now, because if stuff like that's happening, then football is just has just completely lost the plot. Right, we're going to wrap up with the previews with the final game, game number 8, and narratives, derbies. This one is absolutely full of it, Mo. The Sergio Ramos derby, PSG against Real Madrid. This is a humdinger of a game. Ramos back to Madrid, Messi against Real Madrid, Benzema against Ligue 1. Ramos has done an interview in the last couple of days just to kind of stoke things a little bit by saying that he'll fight to the death for PSG. They took the bet on him this summer. Real Madrid let him go. You know, he's determined to knock Real Madrid out. There's no love lost between him, despite spending 16 seasons there. So just looking at the teams and looking at the situation, building up towards it. PSG have flip-flopped a little bit in the Champions League so far this season, but the little genius, he's starting to purr, he's starting to get into gear. 5 goals for Messi in the group stages, and injuries permitting, provided we're in a position where everyone's fit, we know that Poch will go full throttle. It'll be Neymar, Mbappe and Messi, because he's under so much pressure to go and win the Champions League. But we talked about Guardiola, and one of the questions that constantly comes up every season, one of the questions that always comes up with PSG is getting that midfield right, getting the selection right, getting the structure right, because Messi, Mbappe and Neymar will score goals against any team in Europe, but they have to get this midfield right, because Casemiro, Toni Kroos and Luka Modric are the oldest gunslingers in town. They've played in every setting, and if you're not set up right to stop them dominating the midfield, they'll just blow you away.
As we've seen already in La Liga this season, right? Kroos, Modric and Casemiro can be gotten at in the early parts of games, right? And they can take a while to get going into games. This has always been the case then, to be fair, even going back to when they were at their peak.
Doing that is
you can get Madrid, but the thing is, they have one of the greatest front-running midfielders I've ever seen. Once they have a lead, or even just a route into the game, you're in big trouble. And here's the problem with putting them behind in games. Here's the problem with doing that. Courtois is the best goalkeeper in the world right now. Benzema is the best number 9 in the world right now. Sorry, Robert, it's true. I don't care how many goals you put by Gareth Firth. And Vinny Jr. is making good on his enormous potential. So here's the problem with playing Real Madrid is you have to put them on the back foot to get at that midfield, to upset that midfield, right? And you can't do that because Courtois is too goddamn good. And just when you think you've got them rattling, like Atletico Madrid did at the weekend, you're thinking, oh, we've got them here. Karim Benzema comes out of nowhere, Vinicius Jr. comes out of nowhere, and there's a goal. And then you're 1-0 down. And then that midfield's like, oh, we've got the lead now. We've got you now, boys. And then that midfield just goes to work, man. And they can control the game. Toni Kroos is the pass master. Luka Modric is a magnificent footballer, phenomenal. In the last 15 years, he's probably the fourth best central midfielder of all time after Xavi, Busquets and Iniesta of this last 15, 10 years. Phenomenal player. Just exceptional. And Casemiro, obviously, the tackle machine. Yeah. How do you put this team behind the eight ball? How do you do that? Because once they have control, they will just start again. And they're masters of it. They won 3 Champions Leagues in a row, for God's sake. They know how to do it. They're really, really good at it. Even if their league form is struggling, which, by the way, it's really not right now. They look incredible. They know how to negotiate Champions League ties. But on the flip side, 45 games against Real Madrid, 26 goals, 14 assists. Right? If there's one guy in the history of the world, in the history of football, that can kill Real Madrid, it's PSG's number 30. Anyway, that sounds horrible to say, but it's true. Messi is phenomenal against Real Madrid. Neymar is phenomenal against Real Madrid. Neymar's played them, I think, 10 times? 10 times he's won, 4 times. He's got 3 goals, he's got 5 assists. He's really good against Real Madrid. He's usually excellent. He took part in, of course, that amazing 4-0 win at the Bernabeu without Messi. You know, Mbappe is just brilliant against everybody. We know Mbappe is great. So he's auditioning for Florentino Perez. He's probably going to go there in the summer. He's going to want to make a big impression about, look how good I am. Look what you're signing. Di Maria, lots of angry feelings between him and Real Madrid. He'll want to do well. Ander Herrera wants to fight everybody. Ander Herrera wants to fight everybody. Marco Verratti, Real Madrid tried to buy him aggressively multiple times, only to be rebuffed. He's obviously... And the thing is, PSG are a mess, right? Look at them, watch them in the Liga, even the Champions League, they're kind of a mess, right? Poch hasn't really got a handle on the team. One thing that can galvanize teams like this is a big European victory, right? A big, amazing landmark victory over a big European team, right? Now, Man City, with all due respect, are not a big European team. Real Madrid are huge, a massive European team. Now, you want to galvanize this team. You want to make this team believe they can go all the way. They beat Real Madrid at the Parc des Princes. That's going to go a long way to doing it. Gigi Donnarumma, amazing goalkeeper. This could be making it him. You know, Marquinhos is phenomenal. Marquinhos is an incredible defender. Great goal scorer, great defender, great everything. Hakimi, the player that Real Madrid let go for 40 million to Inter, is now coming back to haunt them. He's a freight train. Watching him and Fulham Mendy race each other up and down that touchline is going to be incredible fun to watch. Those two are so fast. You know, it's almost impossible to pick a winner because obviously Real Madrid we know can do it and we know are great. But with PSG, they've just got the individuals that can just put Madrid's lights out. In particular Messi and Neymar and Mbappe. Having those three combined, especially with Messi, he struggled a bit in the Clásicos. Well, after Cristiano left Spain, didn't really have the same motivation, didn't seem to anyway. But the guy that did help keep a lid on him in those Clásicos is now on his team. And that's the fun thing. As much as I think Messi is going to be a deciding factor, I think the ultimate deciding factor in this game is Sergio Ramos. Because as soon as that ball came out of that hat the second time to draw them together, Ramos is in there with the PSG physios. Right, my physical preparation. I need to peak in these games, boys. I don't care how little or how much I have to play now. I'm peaking in these games. He is an incredibly vindictive man. In a good way. He is... As much as anyone else in the history of football, even Cristiano Ronaldo, he is the most clutch goal scorer in Champions League games I've ever seen. You know, he's coming for Real Madrid. I know he spoke very lovingly about Real Madrid when he left and blah, blah, blah. He's mad as hell that Perez didn't give him the deal he wanted. He's mad as hell. He wanted that deal. Perez didn't do it very sensibly, by the way, Perez set himself up very, very nicely. But he's coming. And I think no matter what happens, if either I think PSG are going to go Messi and Mbappe Neymar are going to blow Real Madrid away, too much firepower, or it's going to be a tight, tense time. Messi will score, Benzema will score, whatever. And then right at the end, Sergio Ramos is going to pop up in the Santiago Bernabeu, last minute of the game, header, win the game, PSG, not Real Madrid out. It's going to happen, and you'll know it's going to happen.
I think that's the greatest description I've ever heard of Ramos. So well in, Mo. Right, you said it was incredibly difficult or impossible almost to pick a winner in this, but that's exactly what I'm going to ask you to do as we wrap up with a quick fire 60-second results prediction for each game. But we'll give you a break, Mo. We'll let you kind of relax after your Ramos rant. So Tom, I'm going to go to you first on this. Just a quick fire. We're going to go through each game. We'll do the order that we've gone through the game. So we'll start with Salzburg Bayern. And we'll wrap up with PSG against Real Madrid. Just give us your prediction on who is getting through and who is going to be the makeup of the quarterfinals. Take it away.
So Salzburg-Bayern, the most one-sided tie of the whole thing. Nothing other than a Bayern victory there. Sporting Manchester City, a test for Manchester City, but again, comfortably, whatever the scoreline is, going back to the Etihad, Pep side are through. Chelsea-Lille. Chelsea have shown vulnerabilities, but I have no reason to doubt that they'll easily bypass an average, at the moment, domestic Lille side. As regards to Benfica-Ajax. Ajax, wow. You know, if the draw opens up for them, they could do something special. Benfica are just a stepping stone along the way. Comfortable Dutch victory there. Atletico-Manchester United. Really enjoyed previewing this one. I think Rangnick's going to do it. So I think Rangnick will put on a bit of a masterclass there as regards to improvements with Manchester United. We'll see them in full fruition as regards to the last 16. So United to get through there. Villarreal-Juve, the least glamorous tie of all them. Juventus, I think, will just about have enough to put that one. Inter-Liverpool. Liverpool, my team, to win the whole thing in terms of we're asking for an early prediction. So I can't see them being stopped by Inter whatsoever. PSG-Real Madrid. I'm going to go with Ancelotti. I think he has the side arguably as well. You know, not arguably, he does for me have that side that's capable of winning the whole thing. Him against Pochettino, but yeah, Real Madrid for that one.
Okay, fair enough. Right, some strong predictions there from Tom. Mo, I'm going to throw it over to you. Straight eight, give it to us. What is your predictions for the last 16?
All right, Salzburg Bayern, their Upamecano derby. It's Bayern Munich. They're going to win easily. Could be an Arsenal-style 10-goal aggregate win. Sorry, they used to do it to Arsenal, for clarification. Arsenal never did that to anybody. Sporting Man City, again, I think Man City are too good. They'll beat them over both legs. They've got too many Benfica players, if nothing else. They've got too many Benfica players to let Sporting get a win. City went over two legs. The Eden Hazard / Joe Cole derby, Chelsea versus Lille. I'd like to think Lille could trouble Chelsea a little bit, but then I'm basing that based on how Chelsea are playing now. By the time February rolls around, Kante will be fit and it probably won't be a contest. Chelsea will win again quite easily. The Benfica versus Ajax. I mean, yeah, look, Benfica are okay. They're good. Ajax are genuinely great. I think as Tom says, there are four teams better than them, right? Chelsea, Liverpool, Man City, and Bayern Munich. If those four teams all end up drawing each other in the quarters and semis, Ajax could win this or at least get to the final. They'll beat Benfica. Atletico Man United. Look, again, Cristiano Ronaldo knocks Atletico Madrid out of the Champions League. Locks Diego Simeone out of the Champions League, I should say, over and over and over again. It's going to happen again. I'm sorry, Cholo. I really wish you had a chance, but you don't have a chance. It's going to happen. It happened in 2014, 2015, 2016, 2017, and 2019. It's going to happen in 2021 as well. 2022 even, sorry. So, that's that. Villarreal, Juventus. Man, I don't know. Villarreal, I suppose. They could do it. They're good. Why not? Inter Liverpool. I would love Inter to do this, but there's no way in hell they get past out of Anfield alive. They might go into Anfield with a lead, even frankly. I think they're being underrated a lot of people, but they're not coming out of Anfield with anything but their shirts and their boots. Everything else, Liverpool are taking it. They'll take everything, the kits, the everything, corner flag, team badges, everything. And then PSG Real Madrid. I mean, this is the one legitimate one you can go either way. It's really, really tense, really open. Who could win this? But you know what? As Tom said, Real Madrid, I'm going to go the other way. I'm going to say PSG. I think Sergio Ramos, this is the Sergio Ramos effect. I just think he's nailed on to score the winner. It's written in the stars, you know? They got rid of him. They teamed him and Messi up, Real Madrid and Barcelona. They've teamed up those two at Champions League. I think that, you know, this team is desperate to win the Champions League. Beating Real Madrid would be a huge statement and a huge way for them to get confidence of themselves. And yeah, with Ramos missed a clutch around, yeah, I think he's going to do it. 93rd minute maybe again in the Bernabeu. Let's see.
I think I'd agree with most of them. Just spinning through on my own prediction. Salzburg, Bayern, yeah, I think Bayern fairly comfortably. I've been impressed with Salzburg, but Bayern are just an absolute machine so far this season. Sporting Lisbon against City, bigger tests probably lie ahead for City, and I still think they'll come a cropper maybe in the quarters or the semis, but should have no issues here. Chelsea against Lille will be a bit closer than maybe expected because Lille are having issues in Ligue 1 at the moment, but if they get certain players, Renato Sanchez back in the team, they'll give him a few problems, but Chelsea should just squeeze it. Benfica, Ajax, I think ultimately whoever goes through here is probably going to get knocked out in the next stage, but Ajax were so good in the group stages, it's difficult to look past them getting past a fairly average Benfica team. Atletico Madrid against Manchester United. If this was 2018, if this was even 2019, I'd be putting the house on Atletico Madrid to go through. But Manchester United, or probably more directly, Cristiano Ronaldo, I think are going to knock them out in this one. Villarreal Juventus, as Mo said in his preview of this, neither of these teams really get the pulse racing, but I think Villarreal have got some good pace in the right areas of the team and Juventus are just sinking like a stone. So I'm going for Emery into the quarters. Inter against Liverpool, yeah, I just think the sheer force of Liverpool will be more than enough. The only factor that could potentially influence this is that if there's no fans in Anfield, if we're in a COVID lockdown situation, that could impact this significantly. But Liverpool have been magnificent, so I think they're nailed on to go through. And for the last game, Ramos, Messi, everyone else thrown into the pot, I'm going with Tom. I'm going with Real Madrid to win this. PSG, incredibly talented, but both of these teams, their forward lines, they need the midfield to get the ball to them. And I think Real Madrid are far more capable at that. And crucially, I don't think PSG have the midfield to outfox Luka and co. So that's my predictions. I think we've agreed on most of them, but there's probably going to be a few surprises. And that's the beauty of predictions, that we can play this back to both of you and make you realise just how wrong you are in February. Okay, right. We're going to wrap it up there for the Squawker Talker podcast, Champions League last 16 preview review show that we've been doing today. Mo, Tom, as always, thanks so much for your time.
No
thanks
problem.
Thanks for having us.
Great stuff indeed. Next week, we'll be back with the last show of 2021 with the Squawkers The Most Award, the Squawkers version of the Ballon d'Or, the PFA player and the Oscars, everything all wrapped into one. Mo, myself and one other guest will be previewing and getting stuck into that in 7 days' time. If you click subscribe up there, top there on this episode, you can get access to that brand new podcast as soon as it is ready. Thanks for listening and we'll speak to you again very, very soon.